Senator from the 14th was seeking recognition.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to inquire the senator from the 11th.
Senator from the 11th, do you yield?
I yield, Mr. President.
You yield, Senator. He yields, Senator. You may proceed.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, but also thank you for presenting this amendment because I think it is a step in the right direction. A lot of what we've heard so
far... Senator, I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you.
That's usually not a problem.
I guess I'm getting older. I don't want to be fired.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Thank you, Senator.
All right. Well, I wanted to thank you for even presenting this amendment because a lot of what we've heard today is that we are trying to get in line with the federal government. And, you know, this is an inconsistency, actually, because in federal law, there is no age limit for seniors or people who are older who are trying to get a job and discriminated against. We both have the same level of foundation, which is 40 years old, but in Missouri, we actually have a cap which is at either 65 or 70 years old. So if we're trying to get in line with federal government, I would say that we shouldn't have any caps whatsoever.
You know what president initiated that? Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Did he?
Because if you remember when he was president, he was beyond the federal retirement age, and he said that people of merit should not use age as a way of defining that.
You know, another Republican president, pretty interesting, 2008, George Bush, he actually broadened the ADA Act of 2008, and he said that it went far beyond what had happened years prior, that what was intended for seniors or for those with disabilities was that they would not be discriminated against at all, but between the original language for the ADA and 2007, there are several cases that limited those with disabilities. And so...
Excuse me, Senator. Visitors are reminded there's no cameras in the Senate chamber while we are in debate. Thank you. Proceed, Senator.
Thank you. So in 2008, George Bush, and when he signed the ADA Amendments Act of 2008, actually outlined, you know, why there shouldn't be any constraints on those who have disabilities. And in this act, I'll just read a couple of things. It says, in enacting the ADA, Congress recognized that physical and mental disabilities in no way diminish a person's right to fully participate in all aspects of society, but that people with physical or mental disabilities are frequently precluded from doing so because of prejudice, antiquated attitudes, or the failure to remove societal and institutional barriers. And, you know, that was a Republican president.
Well, let me ask you something. I know this is your inquiry, but I'm famous for interrupting people's inquiries. No, let me ask you something. You bring up disabilities. Do you think in the status quo, do you think in the 19th century, without the protection of law, do you think in the normal course of a company's doing business or whatever, and companies exist, they provide employment, but their motive is profit, which is part of the system. I mean, that they've got to have that. That's the engine of it. I'm not faulting that. But in that motive, without the protection of law, how many disabled people would be hired without the protection of law in this society?
Not
more or less? I mean, if you didn't have a law like what you referred to, would it be more or less?
Less. Definitely.
I mean, how many disabled people were hired in the early part of the 20th century?
Well, let me just tell
you
this.
I mean, weren't they treated very poorly? They didn't have employment opportunities.
Absolutely.
Neither did African Americans. Neither did too many women. Right? Without the protection of law, why does the law exist? To try to attempt to make a fair playing field. Right?
Well, I will tell you today, I had a meeting about 11:30 this morning, and I was at one of the school district offices, the administrative building, and the person at the front desk, I noticed she's a little bit different, and it is a prominent school district that I'm referring to. And I could tell that this person had a disability, and I thought, how wonderful is this to walk into this administrative building, and this individual is helping guide people like myself and others to the right place in this school district. And I thought it was amazing. I thought it was truly, truly an example of what George Bush actually wanted to happen. And so I hope that in the future we're able to be as broad-thinking and broad-minded as George Bush was when he signed the ADA Act of 2008. But you mentioned a case earlier today. It was Doherty versus the City of Maryland Heights. And I don't think that the sponsor of the bill had a copy of it. I have one here. And I wanted to go through it just briefly and read a couple of things from it, because we talk about summary judgments here. And one of the things that they talked about is that a summary judgment should seldom be used in employment discrimination cases because such cases are inherently fact-based and often depend on inferences rather than on direct evidence. Now, that's from the opinion. That's a very key thing to point out. I think these judges had a lot of foresight when they made that determination. But, you know, I'm concerned with taking away a citizen's right to have a jury. That is absolutely fundamental. Absolutely fundamental. And because they want to be judged by their peers. That is a right that each and every single one of us have. But when you go through the process of a summary judgment, there are all of these barriers that are between trying to become whole again. If there is a person who has been discriminated against, they feel as though something has been taken away from them, and they're trying to go through a process to become whole. But when defendants are able to go through the path of the summary judgment, that limits, it does two things really. It limits the ability of that plaintiff, but also what that does is take away part of the democratic process. I mean, it's so expensive to go through the whole summary judgment thing, number one, and a business could afford to do that. But if you are a victim, if you are a plaintiff, one of the problems that you're facing is not only that limitation, but you're not judged by your peers. There's a judge who makes a determination. And, you know, that's pretty difficult because that means that one person is making a decision instead of a group of people who are from your state or from your area. And, you know, frankly, I think we should have juries that are available to these people who are trying to become whole again. Now,
well, Senator, today you're the jury. Now, let me ask you a question. Have you ever noticed in gubernatorial appointments when there's an appointment and some decorated police officer comes before this body or a committee, we always make a point of saying, oh, thank you so much for your service. We so appreciate the dedication that you've given to this job. Now, the case you brought up, Doherty versus City of Maryland Heights, that individual was a captain in the police department, okay? And even though the management admitted that that was the reason, under the senator from Andrews' bill, he's removing that whole rung of the ladder. He's removing that whole rung of the ladder. That police captain, who in another circumstance, on another day, in this very same body, would come before us and we would say, oh, thank you for your service. Thank you for protecting the public your whole life. But right now, we're the jury, and we're saying, well, even though your management admitted that they got rid of you because you were too expensive, that's just not convenient at the moment. The other thing, too, is I was talking to you about the law. The law sometimes protects dumb acts, okay? And it's kind of a dumb act to take a bill that the governor vetoed and pretty much file the same thing, and you didn't have the votes to override it and veto, and so you just kind of come out the next year and file it again. And that's the part I don't really understand about this, is this is essentially a rehash of the same thing. But I also know that the law protects that, you know, and the rules of the Senate protect that we're going to just rehash this bill because a few corporate interests say this is our priority. So,
well, you just said corporate interests, but what is pretty interesting is that a lot of these cases, these big verdict cases, have to do with public entities. So
yeah.
We're looking at Maryland
Heights.
But
the senator from the 4th pointed out they're sort of exempted at some level from the bill. And by the way, ironically, even though it's purported that this is about job creation and better business environment, the senator from Andrew's bill takes away the individual and puts it all on the corporation. Now, I don't know how you're going to... I know this is left over from Fix the Six or whatever it was called, but how does that fix anything? Because tomorrow we're going to be dealing with workers' comp where we don't want them to sue at all. So I don't get this. Let's get the individual out of it and put it all on the corporation and then or the company or the entity, and then we're going to say we're doing this to create a better business environment. If I was a company, I would think, why don't you let me get rid of this bad actor? And why doesn't most of the legal liability fall on that individual who I didn't know was a bad individual? That's what I'm not walking through on this and completely understanding.
That's a fundamental problem. The burden is now on the plaintiff if we go through the summary judgment. And that is unfortunate because obviously there's just cause. I mean, there are several different steps, as we know in McDonnell Douglas versus Green, that there's several steps that you have to go through for the process. And it could be quite complicated. Just establishing pretext. I mean, was there some reason why the employer may lie? We know that sometimes employers lie. Also, we have to look at articulate the legitimate discrimination. Did the employer fire the person for their race or for their code word? You know, as black people, we know the code word is attitude. We always hear attitude. So, you know, that is another test in the process established in Title VII under McDonnell Douglas versus Green. And then the plaintiff has to establish evidence. Hopefully I'll say this correctly, I'm not an attorney, but the prima facie. And you have to look at whether or not this individual is a protected class. Were they qualified for the job? Was there an adverse action? Are they or were they similarly situated to someone else who is not within a protected class? And then was the job still open? So these are some of the things that we have to look at. And some of the barriers, frankly, I will say that I was kind of shocked when I was doing some of my studying because I found out that the Green in McDonnell Douglas versus Green was Percy Green, who is a civil rights activist in St. Louis City and who has done a lot of good things so that we can move in the right direction as a state, and that's since 1964. Mr. President?
Senator from the 14th.
I would like to inquire of the senator from the 10th.
Senator from the 10th. Do you yield to the senator from the 14th?
Oh, I'm sorry.
She yields, senator. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr.
You were done with the senator from the 11th. I get that.
You know, it's all those times I think I can talk and I can't. So I just did my thing this time. Okay, so there are several cases that we can look at that moved us in the right direction. McBride versus Rittner School District was one of those cases. Hill, we look at, I want to say, a couple of others, and I'm trying to figure out where they are in my notes. But as I was talking to the senator from the 11th, a lot of these major cases are governmental entities that are being sued. And there's been a conversation in this body that this is pro-business. But if you are a victim and you want to sue, you, an employer, whether it be a governmental entity or a business, you know, they have the option of you know, limiting the conversation. They can settle. You know, sometimes the easiest thing to do is to settle out of court. Or you can go through the entire process. And that entire process can be very long. It can take a lot of money. So in the cases where there is a long case, a long trial,
sure,
long discovery, all of that kind of good stuff, or you're doing a summary judgment, how much money do you think that public entity is going to end up paying? And do you think that would be fruitful for the tax base that is supporting that governmental entity?
Well, I think that you actually hit on something that they consider all the time is, you know, are we going to spend more money defending this claim than we are if we just settled with the person and they take into account, you know, the wrong that was alleged and how much it's going to cost to defend it. And I think a lot of times you do see cases settle out of court because it does actually become a drain on resources. And you're right. I mean, well, you're right.
Wow. Can I repeat that? No, I'm kidding. So there are a couple of things that I wanted to go through. Comparing the federal law and looking at the bill that is before us, and I guess what I'm trying to establish here is consistency with the federal civil rights law. So,
you know, I'm sorry, this is your inquiry. I apologize. I have something, too, that's bothering
me. The senator from the 11th does that, too, but it's okay.
Yeah, you know, I've learned from the master. So
motivating factor. In this bill, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, in this bill, you know, it is defined, but when we look at the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it also allows disparate impact claims, and this bill does not.
Really?
Yes.
Huh, I didn't know that.
I mean, that's a big, I mean, the sponsor said we want to get back to 1964, so I'm trying to figure out if disparate claims are allowed.
Okay, so you're saying then, and this is something that I didn't realize, that disparate impact claims are not going to be allowed if this bill passes, but they are allowed under the Federal Act. Is that correct?
Of 1964, okay. Which the sponsor said.
So we're actually not just rolling things back to federal level. We're rolling them back further than 1964, would be your argument.
Maybe 1864?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
okay.
So, and then the same decision test. That is also not consistent. The way that it's defined in this bill and what was enacted in Price Waterhouse versus Hoskins in the Civil Rights Act of 1991.
So there's
that is
another,
also not consistent.
So then there's at least three things that you've brought up where this bill, which is supposed to be making it more consistent with federal law, is actually now going to be inconsistent with federal law if we pass it.
Yes, it would not be consistent with federal law. And then damage caps, obviously. The Federal Fair Housing Act does not have limits or caps on the amount of damages that can be recovered. That's under the Federal Civil Rights Act, and in this bill, It's not the same as the Federal Civil Rights Act. Okay. That's also another inconsistency.
So what you were saying, and I just want to make sure, right now there are no caps under the Federal Fair Housing Act. Is that correct?
Yep.
And this law would put caps on housing claims in Missouri that do not exist in the federal law. So that would be a fourth inconsistency that you're pointing out. Okay. Got it.
So, I mean, I'm not an attorney. That's why I'm asking you questions. You know, I try to do as much due diligence as possible to help out my constituents because that's what's required of us. But I also think because we're going backwards and we've had so much case law that has moved us forward, and I have to say, just in analyzing all of these cases that, you know, we've talked about and that we will be talking about in this conversation, it amazes me that Missouri's actually progressive. We're in a progressive place. I mean, the age cap, I wouldn't say that's progressive, but I would say in other areas it's progressive. Our Human Rights Act of our state is absolutely amazing and provides security to a lot of people. You know, there's a picture that I have in my office, and the picture is of Governor Warren Hearns, and it has Mel Carnahan in it, who was the Speaker of the House, I think, at that point, or the Majority Leader, I forgot what that was, but DeVern Calloway, who's the first African-American female legislator that served in the Missouri House of Representatives, they're in this picture, and they're celebrating this signing of the Public Accommodations Bill in 1964. And, you know, I think they were at Lincoln University when they did that. And last week or the week before, when Russ Carnahan came into my office, you know, he didn't look at me. He said, oh, my God, this picture. This is an amazing picture that puts us on the right track. And his dad was a part of it. You know, the first African-American woman who was elected to the Missouri House of Representatives, who is also my mother's mentor.
Really?
Really.
That's cool.
And her father, her husband, was an Oxford scholar who is my mom's professor at SLU.
What a
and
small
so
world.
When I look at all of this stuff, I'm just like, oh, my goodness, the shoulders that we stand on are absolutely amazing. So anyway, I wanted to ask you a couple of those questions, and you know, the other thing that's inconsistent, we've talked about the ADA, George Bush, I didn't vote for him, but he was quite forward-thinking in broadening the ADA Act of 2008 because there had been so many cases that limited those with disabilities, and it was unfortunate. You know, I think George Bush was right in two things. His stance on immigration, because he was very progressive on immigration, and also this act that I'm looking at right here. You know, and that, you know, we can't say that as liberals too often, that there's something that we like about someone from an opposing party, but that truly is a great example. So, you went to law school. Do you know anything about Griggs versus Duke Power Company, that case?
You know, I actually do, but you're gonna. I don't have it here in front of me.
And I don't either.
But I believe that was. This is really reaching right now. But I believe that's the case where there was a some sort of scheme set up where only certain people could be advanced into management positions or out of the minimum wage positions. And the only way you could do that was by passing a certain test, if I remember correctly. And then there was a question about whether or not that was constitutional. And I may be getting those facts wrong, but that's what I thought that the case was about. And now everybody that I went to law school with is screaming at me saying, no, that was not it.
Well, I think that we will have an opportunity to revisit some of these basic cases that we have seen in the past. What I don't appreciate, I guess, is the the saying that, you know, it's okay to go back to 1964. You know, last year I talked about that. And I really do, as I said last year, think that it's a slap in everyone's face to say that 1964 should be the standard in 2012. You know, because things change. We all change. We all develop. We all have different opportunities. And we should go in that order. But also, realizing that this legislation is an attempt to, again, help out corporations that have done things that are wrong is shameful. I mean, last year when I think the first bill that we passed out of the Senate had to do with taking out approximately $89 million from our general revenue, that corporate tax, franchise tax thing, and then, you know, there was a discussion last week about tax credit reform, and I'm like, are you kidding me?
You know, Senator, you've hit an argument on the head that has really been bothering me as I've listened to the debate on this. Missouri is an incredible place to do business. I think the Missouri Chamber of Commerce was sending out press releases and kind of, you know, saying, look at what all of these national organizations this year alone have said about Missouri being a great place. I've heard everything from like the ninth best to the fourth best state in the union to do business. We've got some of the lowest taxes in the country. We have some of the lightest regulations. We've had tort reform. We've gone through all of this. This is a great place to do business. We are open for business. I've never heard one story of one employer saying to me, you know what? I'm not going to come and do business in the state of Missouri because of your crazy plaintiffs' bar and their employment discrimination laws. I mean, that's not ever once been something that I've heard. I've heard things like, I'm sorry, we're not going to come do business here because there's not enough upfront money to attract us. I've heard them talk about specific issues as related to education and other things in specific parts of the state, but I've never heard anyone once say, I'm not coming to open up a company here in Missouri because it's a bad place to do business. Because the reality is this is a great place to do business.
And you know what I haven't heard? I haven't heard of a corporation leaving the state either because of our Missouri Human Rights Act.
No. I've heard a lot of things about how Kansas gave us a better deal. I've heard that. I've heard something about, you know, other states giving us a better deal, but I've never once said, I got to get out of this state because I'm just getting slammed on employment discrimination cases. Because, you know, that's something as a company they'd really want to, you know, talk about is, you know, I'm big in discrimination and I need to go somewhere where I'm better protected.
Senator, you remember that bill last year that you were speaking on that would so-called limit abortions in the state of Missouri? And I think your quote was like, there were, for that classification, there were only like 50 different abortions for that classification. Well, what about this? Let me give you a number. Last year, there were only like 64 cases that were approved by the Missouri Human Rights Commission to go forward with a discrimination case. 64. So it's a big, big problem. It's a big problem, just like immigration, apparently. Just like all those abortions, those 50-something abortions that you were talking about. And there's 64, only 64 cases that were approved by the Missouri Human Rights Commission last year to move forward with a discrimination case.
That's an interesting statistic. I had no idea.
Yeah, that's why we're here. That's why we're here, to do the big business of the state, to deal with 64 people. That's what we're here for. That's what we're here for. Well, thank you so much for the inquiry, Senator. I certainly appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator.
We're on the motion of the Senator from the 11th, Senator from the 13th. What purpose do you seek recognition?
Before I inquire, I could get five members standing. I'd like a roll call on the amendment.
You have sufficient number standing, there will be a roll call.
Just don't raise that number too much. Can I inquire the senator from the 11th.
Senator from the 11th. Do you yield to the senator from the 13th?
I'm sorry, the senator from the 10th.
Senator from the 10th.
They look so much alike, I get them confused.
Do you yield to the senator from the 13th?
I do.
She yields,
despite
senator, you may proceed.
The fact that he just said I look like the senator from the 11th.
There's going to be several issues that come up, but the one that struck me the most about this amendment, what you were discussing with the senator from the 14th, was how we are going further back. And could you re-explain that? Because I could not hear in the discussion what you two were talking about. We are going further back than 1964.
Yeah, the senator from the 14th was pointing out some ways where we're not actually going back to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, but that we're actually rolling back protections that even the federal act has that we will no longer have in state law.
And what were those?
I believe the ones that she pointed out initially, and I have a couple of kind of opinions about these as well, but the ones she pointed out specifically were that disparate impact claims, which are available in federal law, will not be available under this bill, that damage caps that are available under the Federal Fair Housing Act will not be, there are no damage caps, I'm sorry, under the Federal Fair Housing Act, but we're actually going to be putting in damage caps in state law on housing discrimination claims.
Where's that?
It's my understanding that you would have to look at 213.111.2, sections 2, 4, and 5, that the damage caps will apply to our entire Human Rights Act, which includes housing claims and public accommodation.
Is that on page 5?
But those
five?
Are actually treated differently. Let me see. I've got too many things in front of me. Let me see if I can find that really fast. 213.211 would be page... I don't even see that.
I'm trying to get where you were talking. Chapter 213.101 begins on page 4.
Oh, there it is. So what is your question?
Where was that at in the bill?
The damage caps?
Yes.
I think that's on page 6.
And that, what were you saying, all in subsections 5, 1, 2, 3?
I think what the senator from the 14th was trying to explain to me was that caps are treated separately for housing claims and employment discrimination claims under federal law, and that in this bill they'll all be rolled into one.
And you agree with that assumption?
I would have to look at the federal law to verify that, but I am assuming, I don't have any reason to believe that that's not correct.
You had several questions you asked the senator from Andrew that he was unable to answer those inquiries.
Yes.
That was difficult at times to hear as well. So I know it has become an issue that we tend to pass issues without finding answers. What are those issues and where are they at?
Okay, so here were my main questions. The first one had to do with page 2 of the bill, line 47 through 49. And do you have the actual printed copy of the bill with the line numbers?
Yes, I actually have the bill.
Okay, so it's lines 47 through 49 on page 2. So I had a couple of questions about that. What they're doing here in the draft of this bill is they're changing the definition of employer. And the first thing that they're doing is they're saying that an employer does not include an individual. So from now on, you'll not be able to sue an individual for an alleged harm. And I didn't have any questions about that. But what they've also said here is that you will not be able to sue a bona fide private membership club other than a labor organization, which is exempt from taxation under 26 U.S.C. Section 501C. So my questions were, number one, does that mirror federal law? Because I don't know if it does. I don't know if under federal law that private membership clubs have a special protection. Number two, why did you carve out labor organizations specifically from this protection? And number three, does this include all 501c3s or all nonprofits? My concern is that we're creating an exception that says no 501c3 or no nonprofit will be included in the definition of employer. So you would effectively be saying if someone worked for a nonprofit hospital that they wouldn't have a claim against the hospital.
That question has not been answered then?
No, those three questions haven't been answered.
Okay.
And then my next question, Senator, was relating to the summary judgment standard, and that actually starts on page, and I'm going to have to take just a second to figure that one out because I was looking at a different version with the senator from Andrew. But the summary judgment standard, my concern was that the summary judgment standard that they've included in this draft of the bill does not mirror federal summary judgment standard. And so my question was, where did this standard come from? And was it the intent of the authors to basically do away with the motivating factor and make it the sole factor when someone is fired, and it not just be a motivating factor based on the summary judgment standard?
Could you tell me the page and section where...
And you want to know where that is. So let me find that really fast because I've got two different versions of the bill here. Okay, so the second issue that I was talking about is page 4. It starts on line 7 and goes to page 5 and ends on line 26. And if you'll indulge me for just a moment, I want to tell you what...
That entire section 2 with the two subsections.
Yeah, and if you'll, I know this is your inquiry, but if you'll just indulge me for 1 second, I want to explain my concern. What they'd like to do is change it from a contributing factor to a motivating factor. And the senator from Andrew drew the descriptive picture of a plaintiff's attorney during closing argument who says it just had to be a little tiny bit, and he tears off the corner of a piece of paper and he says, and you know, just this little tiny bit, and you've got to find for my client, the plaintiff. And they want to switch it to a motivating factor. And I'm not going to even argue right now whether or not I agree with that. I'm just going to say that's what they want to do. The problem is that they then go on and set up a summary judgment standard that is going to result in cases being thrown out before trial.
So eliminating the trial step.
And it is so strict, the standard is so strict, that it won't be a motivating factor, it'll be the sole factor. And here's why. If you look at number line 19 on page 5, it says, when considering a motion for summary judgment, the burden shall be on the plaintiff to establish an allegation of discrimination where the plaintiff does not have a direct evidence of discrimination. So this is a situation where the plaintiff does not have the smoking gun document. And I can promise you that's 99.99% of all cases, because very rarely is an employer going to send a memo out or an email and say, I fired this guy because he was old. And then the plaintiff gets a copy of that email and says, okay, well, I've got this document that shows it.
Yes.
So that very rarely happens. So now all of a sudden the employee, when they don't have that direct evidence, the employer may then produce evidence of non-discriminatory reasons for the employment decision. So at that point, in the summary judgment time, which is the time before you go to a trial, it means you're resolving the whole case before you ever go to a jury trial, the employer can come up with anything for why they fired the guy. So they could say he was mean on the phone, or he was late to work, or whatever it was. Anything that's a protected reason to fire someone. If the employer produces evidence of non-discriminatory reasons for the employment decision, then the plaintiff shall present facts to show the employer's explanation is a pretext for discrimination. So it says there, if the employer basically can come up with any reason why that person was fired, then the plaintiff shall present facts to show that the employer's explanation is a pretext for discrimination. The problem I have with this is that a summary judgment motion is supposed to be saying there's no issues that need to be decided by the finder of fact, meaning the jury. There's no issues. But right here, you've got the judge engaging in that very thing. So I'm very concerned that they basically have taken it, even though it says a motivating factor, they've made it a sole factor, and they've also completely gutted the whole meaning of summary judgment. And that was the concern that I didn't get answered by the senator from Andrew.
In the state of Missouri, part of that discussion when you were trying to get these answers, and he had concurred he's going to get back with you with some of these inquiries you made. We're an employment at will state, so you can be discharged and not have any recourse at all. Why are we doing all this? Maybe my question should be him, if we're already an employment at will state.
Well, I'll tell you why they want to do this. Because right now, they want the same, basically, protections that they have on the federal court level. Because right now, even though we're an employment at will state, people still sue for discrimination. And when they have to take their case to federal court,
it's very difficult to get cases.
It's almost always going to be thrown out during the summary judgment phase.
Yeah.
So they want that same protection. They want the same results that they get when they have to defend a case in federal court as when they're in state court.
So the inquiry I have and your answer is, I guess, the motivating factor for this piece of legislation is to make it much more difficult going through the federal courts than the state courts, just like it's more difficult to go to the state courts as it is the circuit courts. So it's a continual raising of the hurdle in a 100-yard dash race. I'm not only going to put another hurdle in that race, but I'm going to make the hurdle higher.
Right, because the reality is that right now, cases are continually dismissed on summary judgment in federal court, and they want that same result in the state courts. The intended consequence that will happen with this is you're going to have fewer plaintiff's lawyers, and I know that a lot of times they call plaintiff's lawyers a lot of bad names down here, but the reality is you're going to have fewer plaintiff's lawyers who will even take these cases because it's very expensive to put these cases forward. And individual employees who have allegedly been discriminated against, they don't have the money to do it on their own. So plaintiff's lawyers take the risk, put up the money up front, and say, we're going to present your case, and we're going to get you your day in court. Well, what the other side wants, and they've got the money to defend these cases, no matter whether it's state court or federal court, is they don't want the plaintiffs to have their day in court because they don't win as often. So that's the motivating factor. They don't win as often when they're in federal court.
So those are the issues I have a better understanding now that you inquired the senator from Andrew about.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator from the 13th.
Now, can I inquire the senator from the 11th?
Senator from the 11th, do you yield to the senator from the 13th? Senator from the 11th, Sergeant at Arms. He yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Senator, I'm sorry I was distracted, but I'm getting old. And
I think we both are.
The voters are terminating my employment, so
yeah.
I want to.
Do you know, real quick on that subject, the one thing I always say is, and time has come, I'm not arguing for another opportunity to serve, but I always tell people when they talk about term limits that an elected official, once they get elected, we're asked to go to Boy Scouts, to give presentations, to anniversaries, to give presentations. We're held in high esteem. But after 8 years, we are treated the same as a felon.
Things
I'm going to I'm going to continue, and you're going to continue to pay our state taxes, our federal taxes. We've never committed a law or a felony, and we can never, for the rest of our lives, serve in a state legislative body. Now, why should individuals, and I've always said this against term limits, who have served and who have never done anything wrong, be held in the same regard as a convicted felon? It's not right. So I'll continue to pay taxes for the rest of my life, but at age 50, I'll be barred from life, or at age 49, I'll be barred from life to ever serve again. So if I move somewhere else in the state of Missouri and I say, oh, that aggravates me and I'd like to run for office and have my voice heard, I cannot do it. I'm treated like a felon.
I'm going to sit here largely moot until you ask me a question, because, you know, you often accuse me of interrupting your inquiry, and I was doing that earlier.
Are you turning a new leaf in your last year?
Yes, I was. You noticed the senator from the 14th just didn't even acknowledge that she was done inquiring to me and just asked for somebody else, and I just thought, well, I haven't interrupted you in the last 5 minutes. But go ahead.
I had a nice inquiry with the senator from the 10th about her complaints, and I've been listening to the debate, and now you had inquired earlier of the senator from Andrew.
Yes.
You inquired about a case in Maryland Heights.
Yes.
And the reason you're doing this amendment is because they're trying to negate a court case of age discrimination that was decided, I take it, at the state court level against the city of Maryland Heights, against their city manager.
In the case of Maryland Heights, which was a pivotal point in all of this and a fundamental point, and a senator from Andrew was correct in that it is a fundamental point, even though the police chief in this circumstance acknowledged and admitted that the reason he was getting rid of this police captain was because the captain had been injured and was too old, and he admitted that. The problem is, for the reasons the senator from 10th said, and also this reason, is in a case of age discrimination, that police captain would have to go to court and say that that was the total factor, that it wasn't just the lesser standard. And so, as the senator from 10th indicated, it's unlikely that now, during the course of a jury trial, okay, and this doesn't even deal with the point she raised in a very valid way about if you make this summary judgment part so tough that this case under the senator from Andrews' bill may not have even made it to court. But here you have a case where management admitted, his supervisor admitted that was the reason. Okay? And so forget about all of those factors. The fundamental is they could have come up with any other excuses. The captain in this case was actually had absentee because he was injured. So imagine that. So, you know, you and I have been in this legislature now for 8 years, you know, and it's always amazing to me how this same police captain, if he came to this body and someone introduced him as a guest, we would all stand up and cheer him or her. And here's this same person who gets fired, and we're pulling away his or her basic right to get appropriate remedy. And it's just that fundamental. I don't understand why with one hand we do one thing, we do things for firemen and policemen in this building out of the best noble reasons. Yet here, in one strike of the pen, in one swoop of the pen, Senator from Andrew is removing one of those rungs of the ladder that not only protected this police captain, but also did that. You know, now, later this week, you and I have been in committee, and a lot of our colleagues in a bipartisan way are concerned about somebody who, because no fault of their own, gets the horrific disease of mesothelioma. And the reason if you put it in workers' comp, the only thing that workers' comp would pay, given the nature of that disease, it would pay for their death benefits. So I guess I don't understand how with one hand we commend people, and yet with the other hand we take it away. It's, and this bill
in this place is
taking
called
away a rung of the ladder that was established where age discrimination is outrageous and inappropriate and should be protected in law. And for the reasons the Senator from 10th mentioned about all of the things leading up to this case, then that's not enough. Senator from Andrew is removing the most basic PIM, and if you remember, specifically wants to do away with findings of this case. Findings of this case are central to age discrimination. Can you imagine if we knew an employer was firing people because they belonged to the National Guard or were veterans? Can you imagine if they did it because they were women? I mean, that's kind of the fundamental problem with some of what is in this bill.
It's a valid point. There's a weed of hypocrisy that can...
But what amazes me, Senator, is that that same police captain, if he came up here, we would stand up and give him a standing ovation.
Where in this piece of legislation, when you brought that case up, did they list that case in the legislation like a
no,
lot of...
No, the case advanced the law to take it from this whole issue of motivating and contributing to that. And by removing that, you're opening that door for age discrimination. And that, and hence my amendment. The whole issue of motivating factor compared to contributing factor. That's what's at stake, and that's what this rung of this ladder, Doherty versus City of Maryland Heights, established.
In what year was that decision that came down?
I may not have the year, Senator.
I was in a leadership class with that city manager.
It was in the early 2000s, 2002, 2003. I think he was fired in 2002.
And what you're doing is on page one, making sure you eliminate age from that, except in cases of age discrimination. So you're trying to make sure that... I'm looking at your amendment. On page one, you're just inserting except in cases of age discrimination as it relates to a decision or action, the protected criterion was a contributing factor.
Three senators on the floor. Senator from Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. President. I ask the bill be placed on the informal calendar.
The bill will be placed on informal calendar with the amendment pending.